Tuning in to The Arts Edge. This is Annie Roach with the show where we look at people's lives and, of course, what inspires them. On today's show, we're going to be featuring four children's authors. I have taken highlights from previous shows and put them into one. If you've been following the show over the last 4 weeks, I have featured four different children's authors who I had the pleasure of interviewing at the Squibby Children's Conference in early May. For those of you who don't know, SQIBBY is the acronym for the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. On today's show, we will be looking at the lives of Allison Atchison, Richard Scrimgeour, Maxwell Newhouse, and Marguerite Roers. So stay tuned. After these messages, we will start things off with an interview with Allison Atchison.
There are many people out there in the need of help, but there are not enough people willing to do so. Pivot Legal Society brings a new and dynamic approach to advocacy on behalf of marginalized people, and they're looking for volunteers. Pivot Legal Society relies on its volunteers and is looking for more, especially dealing with these tight economic times and exceptional demands on their services. Recent developments have overwhelmed the society, and with skilled volunteers like you, they can deal with the new demands and rapid growth. For more information, go to www.pivotlegal.org and email them at info@pivotlegal.org.
And now, before we start our interview with Allison Atchison, here are a few things about Allison. Allison's young adult novel, Mud Girl, was a finalist for the Canadian Library Association's Young Adult Book of the Year. And her picture book, Grandpa's Music, A Story About Alzheimer's, was recently placed on the IBBY list of books for children with disabilities. And finally, her work for adults, Learning to Live Indoors, is published with Porcupine's Quill. Allison has previously taught in the creative writing program at the University of BC. And now we will go to the interview with Allison. So in looking at Grandpa's Music, I think that's a really powerful topic to take on for a children's book, and you did a fabulous job. I was inspired and thinking about what a challenge it can be to bring that information to kids. Right. What was it about the process of writing that book that you were able to go there?
So it really was when I phoned my sister-in-law, and her father lived with my brother's family for 2 years before he went into care, and my nieces at the time were, I think, 3 and 5. Because I remember really specifically asking about the youngest, who was at home all day long mm-hmm. with Grandpa. And I said, you know, what was that experience for her? Was it scary? Was it? And she said, actually, for the older child, it was a bit scary. But for the younger, they developed a really close relationship. Mm-hmm. And he would tell her stories every day. And every day, the stories would change. And at first, it kind of... It really actually freaked out my sister-in-law a bit, because the stories, he would bring them out as if they were life and family stories, but really they were completely made up. She didn't even know where some of them came from. And my niece loved it, and would find it a bit frustrating that he couldn't tell the story he told yesterday, but today's story was even better or more exciting or different. And I thought, okay, so there's actually something... I was a bit frustrated by the fact that all the picture books that I read were all about trying to hold on to memory, because to me that's frustrating, and I would think really sad if you're the person who's there and you can't hang on, and you on some level you might know at certain points that it's going, and it's not, it's not very life affirming. Whereas enjoying the story of the day seems to me to be something quite powerful. Mm-hmm. And then actually, scrabbling around on YouTube, there's a professor somewhere in the States, I think her name is Anne Banting, and she does work, you can actually see her working with people with living with Alzheimer's, and she will bring out pictures and show pictures of, she tries to find pictures of places they will never have been in their lives. And some of the people she works with, they haven't even spoken in years. Mm-hmm. They've just shut down because they know they're going to mess up, or at least at the outset, they know they're going to mess up in some way, so they shut down and they go a long time, shot down, she'll throw these pictures at them and they'll just start riffing. She doesn't want them to remember things. It's like, make it up. Oh. Let's just go with what comes into your head. It's amazing. These people are sitting around telling each other stories, and it doesn't matter whether they're true or they happened or whatever. They're not memories. They're stories. It's really cool to see, as I said in the presentation, that Alzheimer's doesn't have a nice ending. So, you know, this is the day you enjoy whatever that is. That's where the door opened for me when I heard about, okay, my niece took pleasure in the story. So I thought there's something there. And then for me, it switched to music, because music is really quite powerful. And, you know, people, even in the later stages of Alzheimer's, will still remember how to play instruments that they've learned when they're young. So I knew that, you know, art, storytelling and music, and it, you know, it evolved to lyrics, song lyrics. And I mean, it's interesting because the book actually hasn't sold terrifically well. It is, you know, by my public lending rights statement, I can tell that it is in most libraries. But to my way of thinking, it's the sort of book that should be in every library, because it's not necessarily one I would expect for people to have on their shelves at home.
No, but I'm surprised.
But it needs to be accessible.
It's such a current topic. It's such a current thing that people are talking about. Say, the last 5 years, it's just really blown, and people are writing about it more and more.
Right, and there was a huge article a couple of years ago, actually when it came out, shortly after it came out, there was a big piece in The Sun about it, about Alzheimer's and living in the moment and working with the moment instead of past or future.
Have you presented your book to places like the Alzheimer's Society or different wards of hospitals or different care facilities?
You know, it's something I've tried to do, and I know the promotional people in the States, because it's American published, and in Canada have done that.
They have
sent it out to societies, and it's listed here and there. But it's interesting to see that, you know, the stories about memory and hanging on to memory will keep selling, whereas it's something that, you know, it's new. It's a bit different.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder if people are scared of it. You know, scared of the topic and.
It's quite possible. I know, you know, having, you know, you mentioned dementia, and, you know, it was important to have the word in the title, which I was hoping they wouldn't do, because there are so many forms of it, that to just call it by one name.
If you've just tuned in, I'm talking with local writer Allison Akerson about her life as a writer. Up next, following this song, we will go to our interview with Richard Scrimgeour. I would like to dedicate this song to my American cousins on this long weekend in America for Independence Day. Here we go. America by Joel Raphael.
Lingers, but the day keeps moving on. The sun extends its fingers out into the dawn. I'm thinking as I travel, life's mysteries unravel. Only the air around me really knows what's going on. Talk about a trip across this land we call our own. America, America, come home. The city lights are glowing, but the homeless number's growing. The tracks along the roadside, like a memory left behind. The desert driver hurries on his way to Colorado, through
across our great divide. Talk about a trip across this land we call our own. America, America, come home.
And that was Joel Raphael singing America Come Home off of his CD America Come Home, released in 2012. What's beautiful on that song, singing background harmonies, are David Crosby and Graham Nash. So this guy's been around a long time, and he's worked with some pretty fabulous acts, and it really shows in his work. And now I'd like to go to an interview that I had with Richard Scrimgeour that I found very inspiring. To start things off, let's listen to what Richard had to say about his process of writing his children's novel, The Nose from Jupiter.
Well, it's a story about a kid who gets unexpected help from an alien who comes to live in his nose. That sort of sets it up right away.
Where did you get the idea for that?
That character I knew before I wrote the book. I didn't have a plot. I had the character very strongly in my mind. Anybody who writes will tell you that you end up becoming a lot of your characters. You are really all of your characters. So the hero of the story, The Nose from Jupiter, is this kid who's got troubles at home and troubles on the playground and troubles with his love life. And he's kind of anxious about some stuff. And I'm a lot like him. But he gets help from his sort of like an alter ego, a Jiminy Cricket kind of character, this alien from another planet, teeny tiny alien who comes to live inside his nose, because his nose is like a two-bedroom apartment with a front room and a back room and garage for the spaceship. So lots of goofiness happens. The point is, I'm also even more like that alien character. Like the alien character, I'm not afraid, you know? And I'm a smart aleck. I talk all the time. And I'm not afraid to tell the truth. In effect, they are the stronger, the deeper sense of that story is that the two alternate personalities are both part of the same person. The whole thing is really kind of almost invented. And it came when I went through my own life and I talked about the truth, or thought about the truth of my own life, the problems I had when I was 12 years old, let's say. And I asked the two-word question that all stories come down to. What if? What if it had been different? What if I hadn't been afraid? Because I had, you know, a girl that I really liked, and I was afraid to talk to her, and I had, you know, friends' parents who were getting a divorce, and they were being kind of mean, and there were bullies on the playground. I didn't like these things, and I just didn't do much about it because I said, hey, I got to save my own ass. So what if I hadn't been afraid? And that's one of that what-if idea is what stories come from. So I invented this character with my problems, or some of them. I exaggerated them a little bit. And I said, what if a part of him hadn't been afraid? And that's where the Norbert character comes in, the alien character. And the story just evolved from that, because that's the engine that drove the story. Because the alien is not afraid. He talks all the time, and he gets the hero in trouble. And the hero has to deal with his problems. So all of my stories have humor in them. Even the adult novels dealing with dementing old ladies have humor in them. But they also have depth in them. So our man Alan here, it sounds like a goofy story with the alien coming to live in his nose, but it's not happy times at the beach. Alan's parents are getting divorced. There are bullies on the playground who are picking on him. And I'm trying to make that funny and deal with that in a way that allows the reader to engage and also to laugh.
So how does the character grow in that story?
He learns to not be quite as afraid as he was. Norbert kind of teaches him, and mostly he's afraid of, and one of the things he's afraid of is like talking to his dad. His dad's not a bad guy, but he's an absent guy, and he's not really there for Alan. And Alan just wants to tell him he loves him, and he sort of can't work that out. And the relationship with his dad is something that grows in the course of the story, as his own ability to deal with some of the issues in his own life.
So the alien who lives in his nose, is he sort of like a little angel or a devil on the shoulder?
You could certainly argue that he's a Jiminy Cricket kind of a character,
right?
A helpful character. You could argue that he's part of his own personality. You could go both ways. The kids always believe that he's an actual real alien. That's fine. That works for me. But in effect, he's that part of himself, the part of all of us, that is not afraid. Because we're all afraid, and yet there's a part of us that isn't. And if we can address that inner part, that story is one of my most popular. I get a lot of emails about it because it's easy to read. And a lot of my favorite emails are the ones where the parent or the teacher says, I had this kid who didn't want to read, and it was your story that turned him on. The idea of it being my story that opened a world to people.
That's just wonderful.
That you say to yourself, that's why I do this. But I had an email from a kid who said, thank you for writing a story about a kid who wasn't afraid, because he's got, you know, I have some of his problems, and I realize I don't have to be afraid either. And I said, buddy, If you can get to a fearless place or a more aware place from my story, well, that's great.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you find that a lot of kids will email you or will come up to you if you're doing a book talk and it gives them courage?
I don't want to build myself up as Mr. Courage or anything like that, but I certainly get a lot of emails from kids. I get a lot of feedback from kids. Mostly they're just saying, "Aw, you're funny," or "Yeah, that was hilarious," or "I'm your number one fan." But certainly they are aware of the fact that the stories are funny and yet at the same time grim. And the best funny comes from a grim place. Any comedian will tell you that he or she is a sad or angry kind of a person, and this is how they're dealing with the problems, by making fun of them, which is certainly my life.
This is a public service announcement.
Open your eyes, open your ears, open your mind. Bike lanes are becoming more and more common. Motorists need to share the road with cyclists. So check your mirrors, check your blind spots, and pay attention. Stay road safe, stay alive.
Can you talk now, Richard, about your novel Mystic Rose and about characterization in that novel and how it reflects you or how aspects of yourself show up in your writing?
Rose is a dementing old lady. She's 90, she is dying, and she is talking to God beside her bedside. What she imagines God to be. It's a monologue. It's crazy for sure. It's funny. It's super sad because she, as I say, she is dementing. She's not making a lot of sense. And anybody who has dealt with dementia knows that these scenes are heartbreaking and yet kind of funny at the same time. My mom is going through this right now. And you can't not smile at it, even if you have a little tear. And the point, what I liked about Rose a lot, being that character, inhabiting that world, this world where things don't always make any sense, is that you do not know what is going on. And honestly, none of us really knows what is going on. We are all of us the thickness of a membrane away from total mental breakdown. And what happened for Rose is that her past is just falling, the barriers between past and present, reality and illusion, are breaking down. And she actually does think she's talking to God. She actually is dying. She's got her daughter that she's dealing with, and she's living her whole life in little fractured fragments in the course of this story. It was a difficult book to write in that I built it up as kind of mosaic pieces. You don't get the whole picture. You build a piece here and then a piece there and then a piece there, and after a while you begin to see, oh, there's a picture here. These little stones, these little tablets are putting together to make a story. And that was my style with that. But when people say, which character are you most like? Honestly, I'm a combination of a bunch of characters. Most of them, they're characters who don't know what's going on. So Rose, even though she's a dementing old lady, is a whole lot like me. I don't always know what's going on.
So do you find that you write that way, that you may have an idea, but you don't know what's going to happen chapter two and subsequent chapters?
I have a sense of where the book is going. I think the writer ought to have a sense of where, a little road map. But that doesn't mean you can't take a detour off the map. And that doesn't mean that halfway through you can say, oh my gosh, of course, it's different than I thought. I was halfway through my first adult novel when I realized, oh my gosh, the guy's like dead all along kind of thing. And it was one of those backwards moments. I said, of course, he's telling the story this way. And I then retrofitted the story to make it look like I knew what I was doing all along. But in fact, I had the plot come to me halfway through the story.
That must be very exciting
It is totally exciting. It is one of those holy shit moments that you get in the middle of the story. And I love the immediacy of writing, so that your best moments come when you're sitting at the computer and you say, wow, that will work. And then you just keep writing away. Even if you have a sense of where you want to get to in the story, because again, I think a sense of a roadmap, a sense of a destination is a good one. But I don't like a triptych. You know, I don't like everything planned. So we're going to stop here for 2 hours and look at you know, Stony Mountain. And then we're going to get back in the car and drive for 25 minutes. And we're going to stop here at this Tim Hortons for coffee. I don't like that kind of novel writing.
So it makes sense that your characters would like those kinds of lives.
Exactly. And all of my characters are me. And certainly all my narrators are me. One of my characters' books is stars a blind guy. I'm not blind, but I do have seriously corrective lenses. But he thinks a whole lot like me. I like writing all my characters end up being a little bit marginalized. They don't fit in. I've spent my life not fitting in, and none of my characters really fits in. They are like but not part of a a whole lot of other people. So that that Bunny in the Ink Me book doesn't really belong in his class. He doesn't really fit in. He doesn't even really fit in his family.
So can we talk now about your career and how you became a writer?
I always wanted to write, and I was one of those. In class, I was a combination of class clown and brainiac. So I knew all the answers, and I got away with a lot of stuff, but I didn't really belong, and I told a lot of jokes, and I got into a lot of trouble for talking when I shouldn't be talking. I spent time in the principal's office. I'm old enough to remember a time when you could actually be strapped, and I was this close to being strapped. But I was also kind of chatty and charming, and again, smart. And I would be a smart ass, but I wasn't mean. And so I build that character into my stories. I always liked to read. I have probably spent more time reading than anything else in my whole life. And that includes, like, sleeping and eating and other things.
Good to know.
The same. And the idea of story is something I've been fascinated by. On the other hand, I was kind of my own worst enemy because I was so freaking clever. I was so smart. I got scholarships. I went all through school, blah, blah, blah. So I knew everything. And I started to write, and I said, I got this. No, I didn't. Took me 5 years to write a book that's never going to get published. It was a horrible story, and I didn't realize it. We didn't have creative writing back then, so I went to university, and I learned how to write a great essay. That's not the same thing as writing a story. And so I had the wrong kind of talent. I didn't have a story I had to tell because I had a well-adjusted life. I had nice folks who loved me and supported me, and things were going well. That doesn't make a story. Stories work when you really care about something, and it goes wrong. So you show me an 18-year-old writing a brilliant story, and I'll show you a kid who's got something wrong in their life that they are talented enough to be able to exploit. That, I mean, God bless them. And there are certainly lots of writers who are talented and lucky and driven to write really good stories young. I was later. It took me a long time. I wrote years and years, as I say, and it was not a good story. What happened was that I started caring about things. I had kids. That helped a lot. And I had stories that I cared about them. And I got a really simple story. My first story was way too complicated. My advice to anyone starting out is to say, find a really simple story. Follow that. Find a story you like to read and write a story like that.
That is excellent advice. You mentioned that in the Breakout Center, to mimic.
Imitation. No band begins as a one-off. They all begin as cover bands. You start out trying to sound like the Beatles. The Beatles didn't start out trying to sound like the Beatles. They tried to sound like Muddy Waters or Buddy Holly, depending if you were John or Paul. And they found their own sound through imitating others. No artist begins by saying, I'm going to draw stuff. They all go to art galleries, and they all try to copy the old masters. They try to practice. So you imitate.
When new writers are writing, and if they're imitating other writers, is there not the danger that people will look at their writing and think they're copying that?
Well, if they're copying the words, of course. But if they're copying the idea, no, because there are only three basic stories that we're all telling over and over and over again. What makes it individual is you telling your story. So when writes Aragorn, he's saying, Lord of the Rings, that's a pretty good book. I'm going to write one kind of a lot like it, and I'll throw in some dragons. And that's, you can tell what people are reading by what they're writing. And that, to me, there's no problem at all. I'm not going to write like Jane Austen. I wish I could. But no matter what story I'm going to tell, I'm going to do my version of that story. So I love Dickens. I love A Christmas Carol. And I wrote a book with A Christmas Carol as kind of a template. My book, Me and Death, is about a Scrooge character. Only because I'm writing it for kids, he's not a 65-year-old miser. He's a 14-year-old bully. He's a bad kid. And he kind of dies and kind of goes to some kind of heavenly place and meets a couple of ghosts who say, buddy, you've done bad. You can do better than this. And he gets a chance to come back and maybe relive his life. And he learns Scrooge's lessons. I'm using Dickens. I'm clearly borrowing from Dickens. But I'm just saying, it's not even an homage. I'm just saying this is kind of a cool story. It's a Dickensian kind of a story. Every time you go on a journey, you're stealing from Huckleberry Finn. That doesn't mean you're right. I mean, everybody is basing on a guy goes on a journey. A stranger comes to town. Somebody loses something. These are the three tropes of storytelling, and everybody's imitating. So my best advice to any beginning writer, find a book you like a lot and write one just like it. That book will probably suck. You get a lot of your writing styles out, but mimic, practice the way they get into a scene, the way they get out of a scene, how much dialogue, how much description, where do we go to action, where do we cut back? Mimic, mimic, mimic. Learn how. It's like your scales when you're learning piano. You got to practice, and you practice by reading and imitating.
If you've just tuned in, I was talking with Richard Scrimger, children's author. For more information about Richard, you can go to his website at www.scrimger.ca, and you can get a full listing of his books. He's got some teacher's guides. Yeah, check him out and check out his novels. We talked today about Mystic Rose, about The Nose of Jupiter, and he talked a little bit about Ink Me. Check out his website to get a full scope of his writing. He's a very interesting man to talk with and very diverse in his writing, quite inspiring.
Want to do something that's free? Well, get away from the big city and onto your feet. Walk through Port Coquitlam and experience the city's vibrant heritage through their murals. The murals look at the past and the present in different themes, such as community, the environment, and the arts. For more information, go to pocomurals.ca.
During the conference, I also had the opportunity to meet with the coordinator, Ken Kilback. Ken is a full-time kindergarten teacher who also writes stories for children. In 2006, the Piano Press published his poem, There is Santa in the Sky, as a song in its piano guitar music compilation, My Christmas Fun Book Level 1. Ken is very involved with Squibby. He can be contacted through Ken Kilback, KenKilback, at shaw.ca. One thing you might be interested in if you're not currently a member of Squibby, the joining rate is $85 for the year. The annual renewal fee is $70. Please note that members of Squibby do receive discounted rates for conferences and workshops that occur throughout the year. So that's something to consider for you writers out there. Up next, we're going to be talking with Maxwell Newhouse. But first, I have a song for you by Gordon Lightfoot, and I'd like to dedicate this song to somebody I know. I have a great story. Gordon Lightfoot was in Victoria doing a concert some years ago, and he got a terrible review. And my cousin's husband wrote a letter, a personal letter, to Gordon Lightfoot. And just said, you just ignore that. You were fabulous. And I have all your albums, and I think you're amazing. And Gordon Lightfoot wrote him back, a signed autograph picture, and wrote him a letter and just said, thank you. And so this signed photograph sits on their piano, if they have a piano, or perhaps it was a pool table. Regardless, it's a beautiful story, and I love that Ray sent that letter to Gordon Lightfoot, and even more so, I love that Gordon wrote back. So this song goes out to my cousin's husband, Ray, and to the Canadians out there on this long weekend, and of course, to Gordon. Here we go, the Canadian Railroad Trilogy.
Fair land when the railroad did not run, when the wild majestic mountains stood alone against the sun, long before the white man and long before the wheel, when the green dark forest was too silent to be real. But time has no beginnings and history has no bounds. As to this verdant country, they came from all around. They sailed upon her waterways and they walked the forest tall. Built the mines, the mills, and the factories for the good of us all. And when the young man's fancy had turned into the spring, the railroad men grew restless for to hear the hammers ring. Their minds were overflowing with the visions of their day, with many a fortune won and lost and many a debt to pay.